So actually, I want to go in a certain sense in the direction that Jamal was going this morning, looking at some of the more practical dimensions of mystical prayer, even practical and even popular in a certain sense, and move it into that direction, and to get a little more concrete. What I'd like to look at together is one of the more common applications of prayer, which is prayer for healing, healing from illness, and the way this is approached in the Jewish mystical traditions, in Kabbalah and in Chassidut. When we talk about a prayer for healing, we're in the realm of what you'd probably call petitionary prayer. And this is certainly really, and I think for this group in particular, one of the more problematic dimensions of prayer. Petitionary prayer. In Jewish tradition, there are three categories of prayer. Praise of God, thanksgiving to God, and petition, meaning asking God for something that you need. There's a certain sense of generous altruism in this group, so that I think praise of God is something that comes easy to us. A sense of praise, openness, thankfulness too. But what's this petitionary prayer? What's the inner problem and dynamic in petitionary prayer? Okay, and clearly it's that it seems to have a dimension of self-directedness, of ego direction, when you ask God for something. You know, it seems like a lower order of prayer. Is that so? Or as some mystics will see some examples of this, will maintain that petitionary prayer may be the very essence of prayer, with all the paradox involved with that. And this is what we want to look at. By way of introduction, I'm going to approach this, looking at petitionary prayer in the Jewish mystical tradition. It's an academic, also somewhat of an academic setting. So I'm going to approach this so we're talking about healing prayer. So I'm going to look at this as a kind of a medical anthropologist would look at it, and actually with reference to the literature of medical anthropology. But before doing that, I want to kind of orient us to what we're talking about when we say prayer for healing. Okay, for healing, don't have illness, bodily ills. Is prayer for healing essential to the healing process, or is it just, you know, something kind of an add-on? The doctor does the work, you know, and then the chaplain is called into the hospital room, and he says a couple of prayers which give some psychological solace to the person who's sick, gives them a little bit of a boost and a kind of a pep talk. Is that it? Or is there something else? You know, something called kind of it's called in the trade spiritual healing. Is there something more going on? Is healing, is the spiritual dimension or the prayer dimension for healing something more essential? Let me approach this with a story. You know, I'm a rabbi, congregational rabbi. I have congregants who come to me and tell me about their experiences. Some of them are their mystical experiences, some of their less than mystical experiences. One of my congregants who's a friend, a woman who is very sophisticated, extremely bright, you know, over-articulate, and quite skeptical. She told me about a near-death experience that she had. She was in a hospital room for a certain medical condition, and as actually the situation was she had just given birth, complications in the birth, and complications with her after the birth, and she suddenly hemorrhaged. This is a day after giving birth, hemorrhaged very severely. And according to the doctor's account, she lost nearly 80% of the blood in her body. That's very dangerous. She started to feel extremely woozy, and the nurse noticed it. They rushed her into the operating room. And she had the distinct experience of being totally conscious throughout the whole thing, okay? Though she had fainted. Okay, she fainted, but she was totally conscious. She was being wheeled down the halls of the hospital, and she had the sense of floating above, watching her body being wheeled down the halls of the hospital. I come into the emergency room, to the operating room, and she had the sense of sort of hovering in this, just under the ceiling of this room, watching the doctors work on her, you know, on the operating table below. And she could see that they're frantically working on her, and it, you know, they're getting extremely anxious, and she's just watching this with a fairly detached kind of consciousness. And she started to feel she was drifting off and drifting off and drifting off. And the hospital, the emergency room, the operating room was getting smaller and smaller, and she was drifting away. Then at a certain point in this drifting, she heard a voice that said to her, "This is not your time. You have many more things to do in the world." And having heard that voice, she felt herself being pushed gently back down. Okay, she felt a will, as she said it, pushing her gently back down, and the operating room was getting, you know, closer and larger, you know, back down, back down. And she had a moment in which she lost that consciousness that she had been having and woke up, you know, back in her body. She says, and again, this is a very skeptical, articulate, hyper-articulate woman, and she says that as she was being pushed gently back down into her body, she saw the doctors working frantically on her body, and she, the way she put it, is, I think she put it nicely, she said, they were doing what they were supposed to be doing, and they were doing a very good job, but they weren't what brought me back. It was that will that brought me back. And it was that will that helped them do that very good job. Interesting story. Okay. And I think this gives us a kind of shifted perspective on what's going on, kind of the relationship of the biomedical treatment in healing and the spiritual process in healing. Because oftentimes we do regard the role of chaplains and spiritual, you know, support group people, you know, like Harvey and myself, who function in this role, as merely kind of a cheering section for the doctors, you know, we're the cheerleaders. It's not quite so. And the prayers that we offer, as it's understood in real spiritual prayer traditions, when we offer prayer and we meditate on behalf of a sick person, when those prayers are on target and they come from a place of deep sincerity and truth, they're working with that will, that with the capital W, the high, that will, at that level. That will itself, which organizes everything else, including the biomedical treatment. And when you touch that level, then something else is happening. This is where we start to talk about real prayer for healing. Not just saying words that are lovely thoughts on behalf of somebody else, which is always good to do, but something that reaches much deeper. The question is, how can we get in touch with this will when we need to? Yeah?
In the United States right now, about life after life, about near-death experiences that...
Yeah, this is classic. You could point chapter and verse.
There.
Yeah, this is, you know, a classic near-death experience. Okay, it's got all the signs. You know, the gentle voice, the everything. I mean, it's just the drifting off, the classic experience. Oh, so, yeah.
How do you reconcile standing by the patient's bed and praying with all your heart and hoping that it's going to influence something in the spiritual forces, with trust that God knows what God is doing?
You know, in other words, this is perfectly what I want to talk about. How God knows what God is doing, and we're part of that process too. Okay, I'll give you one more story. It's going to take forever, but you know, forgive me. We in my community, another woman. Actually, it's funny. These two stories also revolve around childbirth in interesting ways. Another woman was pregnant with a child and was discovered to have a massive lymphoma in her abdomen. I mean, so she was pregnant, and then with a massive lymphoma, which made her seem double pregnant. You know, just absolutely devastatingly life-threatening. The doctors, her doctors wanted her to abort, and then they would remove the lymphoma. They'd have to do radiation treatment. It would have been fatal to the infant anyway, to the fetus anyway. That's what they wanted to do. When a rabbi is faced with a question like this, and I was faced with the question, and comes to me and asks, what should I do? The rabbinic tradition gives great weight to medical wisdom. And in a situation where it would be threatening to the life of the mother, it's different than Catholic tradition on this, but in Jewish tradition, when threatening the life of the mother, the rabbinic decision would be, in this case, to abort and do what the doctors say. She would not have any part of it. She really felt she wanted to have this baby and to go through with it no matter what. So then we were faced with, in the community, with what to do here. So we arranged a night of prayer for this woman. My entire synagogue came out to this. We had a rabbi teaching Torah. Prayers said, for a good part of the night, the Psalms and other prayers. And then a group of us who have been meditating for a good 15 years together got together within this context and began a particular meditation on her behalf. And I could get into detail on what was going on in the meditation group, but we were quite aware of where her life force and her soul were at in this process. And the people learning, the people praying, the people meditating were all involved in the process of supporting her life through this. We were schwitzing at the end of this evening. I was just sweating. It was such a profound experience together for the entire community. Everybody was in the synagogue or in a place connected with the synagogue. So we had this thing. A couple of weeks later, the doctors said to the woman, "We can't explain this, but your lymphoma is shrinking." And a month later, the doctor said, "It's gone." She gave birth to a beautiful baby girl, and with all due respect to the sheikh yesterday, that's also a great blessing. The baby girl is healthy, the woman is healthy, never had a recurrence of this lymphoma. Okay, now I don't know what to tell you. These are miracle stories, right? It's a beautiful story. We all had a role in this. God knows what he's doing. She's doing. And somehow, what's going on? And the whole community gets together to pray for a person, to learn for a person, to meditate on behalf of a person. That in itself, this woman was healed, her baby was healed, my community was healed. Okay? And there's, there's something going on in a lot of dimensions. God really knows what he's doing. Okay? Really knows. On dimensions that we can't even imagine. God knows we're doing so much that he gives me a story like this that we can share, and then the story goes on. And other people, tell this story in my community. They love to tell this story. And so the event continues. The consciousness of it continues. That's just, in another dimension. Yeah, Gertie. I don't like to play theological games with this, but since we would-be mystics here, then this is the level I can only allude to, but in the meditation group that we had, which was that night, it was about 9 or 10 of us of the group. We had a different sense. It wasn't forcing God, but there was a certain, I don't know how to call it. There's a certain kind of release and coaxing at the same time. Okay, there's a certain kind of there's a gentleness to this process and an opening to the process, and it's not forcing. Okay, and we, the meditative group was, we would, as we described it the experience that we had was we were kind of turning the world upside down, right side up, upside down, right side up. Why that was at all useful, I'll have to get into that in another time. But there's something else going on. Okay. And it's not forcing. You won't accomplish anything in mysticism by forcing. Okay. So now, to set this up, to talk now about the experience of, and I'm going to talk about strictly from the Kabbalistic and Hasidic point of view, how mystical, two strategies for mystical prayer for healing. Okay, it's goal-oriented in a certain sense. And yet we'll see, again, as Na'alima pointed out, you approach the goal by not approaching the goal. To set this up in terms of what we can expect and how prayer for healing works, I want to set up the kind of medical anthropological background for this. Now, this is a field, it's an academic and scientific field, medical anthropology. And they distinguish between what's called treatment of disease, which is defined as somatic dysfunction, whatever the cause of that is, and treatment of illness, which is defined more broadly as a patient's experience of a lack of attunement in the world, to greater or lesser degree. This lack of attunement can be experienced in a number of different ways. It can be physiological, it can be psychological, it can be social, it can be moral or spiritual lack of attunement. And these anthropologists suggest that Western medicine in the modern era has become really focused on disease-directed therapies, treating the patient with a mechanical problem. And we're aware of this. Western medicine has been very effective in this, and developing specific therapies for specific diseases. But less attention has been paid to the broader significance of illness per se. And I'll give you an example. Today, a Western doctor, it's the in thing today, a Western doctor will treat stomach ulcers pharmacologically. Okay, the current theory is that a stomach ulcer is caused by a bacterium. Okay, so the doctor gives a very intense regimen of antibiotics for this specific bacterium, and the stomach ulcer is healed, and the doctor thinks his job is done. Okay, as long as the ulcer is controlled. And he might give some brief recommendations about diet to the patient, but it doesn't go much further than that. And that's his responsibility, and he's done his job. But the treatment of ulcer, not as a disease, but as an illness, would entail seeing that the primary issue here with the patient is in terms of how the patient interprets the demands of his world and how he or she embodies those demands in their body and experiences that embodiment. So even if the physiological dysfunction has been healed in a certain sense or treated with the antibiotic, if the conditions that precipitated the ulcer in the first place, which might be a certain stress level in the world, emotional stress, that hasn't been addressed. There might be personal relationship issues, professional career issues, social issues that are contributing to a level of stress. If that hasn't been addressed in terms of the general illness, then this illness will appear in either another round of ulcers later down the line or some other displacement to another body dysfunction. Okay. So illness tries to address the patient's being in the world in a more global sense. Now, the cultures and the religious traditions that have folk healing traditions, and this includes Jewish tradition, tend to see the patient in this more broad sense. Okay. And ethnologists have studied these healing rituals of various folk and religious cultures and have come up with a number of models for various type of folk and faith healing methods. And I think these methods have some broad, we can sort of get some broad similarities between them. But to illustrate it, let me give you an example straight out of the Talmud, okay? The most normative body of Jewish law, canon of Jewish law. Talmud has an interesting story. It's in the tractate Brachot. It goes like this. Rabbi Chia bar Abba got sick. I'm quoting. Rabbi Chia bar Abba got sick. Rabbi Yochanan went to visit him. Rabbi Yochanan asked him, "Are your sufferings dear to you? You like to suffer?" Rabbi Chiya bar Abba said, "Neither them nor their reward. I'm tired of this." Okay. Rabbi Yochanan said, "So give me your hand." And he gave him his hand, and he lifted him up. First story. Very next story in the Talmud. Rabbi Yochanan got sick. Okay, he's the healer of the first story. Rabbi Yochanan got sick. Rabbi Chanina, another rabbi, went to visit him. Rabbi Chanina said to him, "Are your sufferings dear to you?" Rabbi Yochanan answered, "Neither them nor their reward." Rabbi Chanina said to him, "Give me your hand." He gave him his hand, and he lifted him up. So the Gemara asks the obvious question, right? The obvious question is, so Rabbi Yochanan's the master healer, why couldn't he heal himself? Right? So the Gemara answers, Ein chavush matir atzmo mi beta asurim. A prisoner cannot release himself from the jail. It's an interesting story. I mean, in a certain level, this is the principle we're familiar with. A cardiologist doesn't treat himself. You know, it won't be effective, and insurance won't pay for it. Okay, so you know, it's that we know on a certain level. But there's something else going on here, and the Gemara is really, you know, putting us in touch with this, and even putting issues of therapeutic touch aside, which are alluded to in even a later part of this tractate, this section. The principle that the Talmud states that a captive cannot release himself from prison, that the ill person cannot heal him or herself, this is what we have to take a closer look at, why this is the case. So now, the medical anthropologist Arthur Kleinman observed certain Taiwanese folk rituals of healing, and the key movement that he identifies as the pivotal act of healing is what he calls the externalization of the problem. Allowing the problem to be played out in a mythical or dramatic way outside the patient. The illness is actually enacted by the faith healer. And the healing of the illness is enacted dramatically by the faith healer. Okay? And this allows room for making a new label for that illness and for reinterpreting and getting a new perspective on the illness in another way. You know, getting outside of yourself in a certain way. And this is what's going on in the Talmudic story. The act of healing takes place with the help of an other. It has to be with an other. There's a really, I think, a profound medical anthropologist just named Thomas Chortis. I don't know if you're familiar with him, Harvey, but he studied the Catholic Charismatic Movement, which is a healing movement based... Well, not, healing movement parallel to and very similar to certain Pentecostal Protestant healing movements, but it's a movement that's grown up in Catholicism itself. I don't know if you've heard of that, Therese. More than you like. I get that sense of that. More than you like. You know, it's Catholic Charismatics. It's probably not entirely mainstream, right? A little controversial. Yeah. There it is. It's a lovely, normative, you know, central movement in Catholicism. Yes.
It's not a movement, it's numerous groups.
That's one of them. There are all those groups.
All right.
There are
dozens of little communities, and they're one of them.
Higati v'lo yadati. Okay. Okay. I will invite some of your comments on this too, because Chortis, in his book The Sacred Self, looks at this their movement anthropologically. It's a terrific book, and he also, as he says it, regards the essence of faith healing as a turning to an other. It can be a small O or a big O, other, to the divine self itself, and this is what we want to explore a little bit. I want to take a look at this also. And from a phenomenological point of view, and this we have to be a little bit self-aware about this process. The phenomenologist Maurice Merleau-Ponty, so a student of Heidegger's also, according to him, human experience is the experience of embodiment. Okay? It's conditioned by being in a body. And more accurately, as he says, it's the experience of being associated with a body. Okay? And the body as the closest and most dominant element in our consciousness. Okay? You know, as an experience, and think about this, the mind is not in the body. As we, if you really look at how you experience your world, your body is in your mind. You're looking down at it. You know, if I look at each of you, I say, okay, you're a body, and there's some mind in there. But you look at yourself, your body is in your mind, not the other way around. Yeah? It's true. The experience that we have in consciousness is our body is in our mind, not that our mind is in the body. Our body is in our mind. That's what it is. And it's the sense of our body that we have, which we subjectify as saying, this is us, this is me, you know, I point here. You know. And it sets up the major mode by which we interpret the world as there's me and there's the other. Now, this is not subject-object. This is different. This is there's what the part of the world that's most associated with me most of the time, that's my body, and then there's the other which shifts around. Okay, that's Merleau-Ponty. And I think we can use this to understand the relationship of health, illness, and healing. The experience of health. What does it mean if I ask you to, what is the experience of being healthy? I'm not talking about a physiological definition, nothing, not a medical definition. What's the experience of being healthy? What would you say? What do you feel like when you are healthy? What do you feel like? Happy, full of joy. Are you happy and full of joy now? No. Oh, okay. That's and that your problem is drawing its attention to itself. Okay. Now, when we're healthy, do we always feel happy and full of joy? Say again. That's a definition of, you know, all systems go. I mean, that's a definition of health. But I want, what's the experience of health? It isn't. The experience of health, really, the experience of health is a non-experience. I am most healthy when I am totally not thinking about my body. I'm just out there in the world doing what I want to do, doing what I have to do, projected out into the world. The minute I start thinking about my body because I have an earache, maybe it healed speedily, or, you know, I'm not feeling well in some way, now my attention is being drawn to my body and I start having experiences of and feelings about the body. But the experience of health is when the body is in the background and not drawing its attention, any attention to itself at all. Okay, it's a non-experience. That's true health. In fact, once I feel happy, I say, oh, I'm feeling good. You know what? That's the first sign you're about to get sick. At least with me, that's always the case. Like, oh, yeah, I'm really feeling energetic today. I'll be sick tomorrow.
When you're sick and you know your whole life.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, but sickness is a it draws attention to itself. You wanted to say?
I actually disagree because I think I know the point why I'm most healthy when I'm training.
Okay, but training is an extreme. That's good. Training is an extreme thing. But I'm asking the general definition, the general experience of health that we have as a baseline experience in our lives is, and we're most satisfied with this is body unself consciousness. No, I.
No.
Those feelings are okay, but I'm saying that's not health in itself. That's not health. That's, you know, and I want to tell you that there's a whole industry, a pharmacological industry dedicated to giving us the illusion of this experience of health, the analgesic antihistamine industry. And that's to try to help the body recede into unself-consciousness. But it never works. You get, you know, a wooziness even with that, and that's a sign that you're not healthy. I don't want to belabor this point, but yes, you can feel, you know, you can feel that vitality. I'm not saying that's unhealthy, but, you know, just general experience is a non-experience. So in... Say again? Oh, you can be mindful. Sure, we have prayers for this in every tradition. Right, but I'm saying just your general consciousness, when you are healthy, you're not thinking about being healthy or anything. Yes, we have moments in which we turn reflectively to God and thank God for our health, but the healthy situation is a baseline of body unselfconscious. Okay? I mean, just have a little faith in this for a while, okay? Flow with it for a moment, okay? This is, you know, we're all, just flow with it. So in this sense, and again, it's based on, you know, this anthropological definition, real healing would be a restoration from illness of body as object, which is what happens in illness. In illness, our body becomes an object that bothers us and draws attention to our earache, you know, before Shlema. Restoration away from that body focus to this body unselfconsciousness. Somehow the Talmud is telling us this, and medical anthropologists say that many folk healing traditions have this. To re-achieve this healing, this state of healthy being, requires appeal to an other. And the question is, what's going on here? You know, it involves some kind of externalization, a shift away from the body focus of illness through the effect of the other, who is absorbing our attention and becomes the focus of our trust, whether that other is a doctor, you know, or the faith healer, or the other with the big O, you know, the divine. Okay. So the question still is, how does this work? How do you make that shift, which is what faith healing or spiritual healing is about? Now, the Jewish religious tradition, folk traditions, religious traditions in Catholicism, I'm sure in Hinduism as well, and perhaps Buddhism as well, Islam certainly, there's often the use of a charismatic other. I'm sure the sheikh functions oftentimes as a healer himself. So someone who's charismatic, who draws your trust and your attention, you know, to him as the other. Okay. The Hasidic Rebbe, the Kabbalist often functions in this way, the rabbi functions this way. This also embraces the clinical definition of a physician as an other. There's power just in the therapeutic relationship itself before the doctor gives any medicine. Just the fact that you've appealed to an other, and that giving of trust over is important. That's part of the process of healing. It should not be overlooked. In our tradition, in Kabbalistic and Hasidic tradition, there are two texts which I want to look at, which really wrestle with this issue of this, how prayer, you know, affects or works through this process of externalization to the other to help facilitate a cure. And if you have these sheets, I have two extras. If you don't have these sheets, if anyone not have, it's a set of two sheets. Could someone pass this over to Alon? And actually, I want to look at them in the reverse order, the bottom one first and then the top one. So we're going to look at two texts that look at how this works. The first, down at the bottom of the page, is from a book called Degel Machne Ephraim, Rav Moshe Chaim Ephraim of Sudelkov. Grandson of the Baal Shem Tov, of the founder of Hasidism, and he's commenting on the verse in the Torah, "Keni Hashem Rofecha," I am the Lord your healer. Okay. God says to the Jewish people. So he says, "For I am the Lord your healer," quote unquote, can be explained according to the way I received from my master, my grandfather, may the memory of the righteous be for a blessing, that all suffering that befalls a person, heaven forbid, is because there is a similar deficiency in the divine presence, as it were, such that the unity is not complete. Therefore, God sends him suffering in order to arouse him to pray for the deficiency of the divine presence, as it were, as it is written, "For I am lovesick." Ki cholat ahava ani. It's a beautiful passage from Song of Songs. I'm sick with love. He will see to it to arouse great love to unify the Holy One, blessed be He, and His presence in a unification in truth, in completeness, without any deficiency. Then, automatically, judgments and suffering will depart from him. This is alluded to in the verse, "For I am the Lord," that is, I, the Divine Presence, will be with the Lord. There will be a unification of the Holy One, blessed be He, and His presence, which is Rofecha, which is your healer. That is, the healing of you. For then, automatically, all suffering will depart and be nullified, and the judgments will be sweetened. Understand this. Okay, that's the text. Just remember for a moment that I don't want to get into the blackboard. We got into trouble with the blackboard. It was starting to be looked at too graphically. I want to move this off of the graphic. It's important to do that. In Kabbalistic theory, and this ties into a theme that has flowed in and out of this conference, there's one can discern, you know, a sense of God as intimately present in the world, called Shechina, divine presence. That's Shechina, right? That's divine presence. That's our sense of the presence of God. And then God Himself, more as He is in Himself. Okay. Now, is that the same or is that different? And that is the question. Okay. It's certainly not different. There's no break between them. But the break in this is in human consciousness. We tend to distinguish these aspects, that there's God, a sense of God's nurturing presence in the world. And then we strain to see, you know, how does that relate to God as He is in Himself? Okay. So God as He is in Himself is what's being called the Holy One, blessed be He. God's presence in the world, in other words, consciousness of God's presence in the world, is what's called Shechina. In this case, being interpreted as the Ani, I, the presence in the world. You know, and the Lord, God in Himself, your healer. So now what is the Degel Machne Ephraim saying here? When a human being is in illness, okay, there is a corresponding, or there is in fact, by definition, not even corresponding, there is a lack of wholeness in the divine being itself. There's a sense of break, or some lack of wholeness between God's presence in the world and God as He is in and of Himself. Okay? And that the illness, as he says, is sent to the human being, meaning it's expressed through the human being to arouse the human being to pray to reunite this consciousness of God in the world and God as He is in Himself. Okay? That's how he's expressing this in, you know, formalistic, Kabbalistic terms. And once that prayer accomplishes what it's supposed to do, and in other words, once the prayer arouses his consciousness, that is the healing itself. What does he mean here? Okay, I mean, can we locate this, you know, in kind of translate this into experience? And that's the question. What does it mean to say that illness that we are sent, in other words, illness that we experience, is a indication, it's a symptom of a lack of unification of the divine? What does it mean to say lack of unification of God? Pardon me? Sounds very dangerous, yes. And it can't even be. And yet, you know, it's exactly happening right now. In every one of us right now. You know, the one thing we can agree on well, forget about definitions of mysticism. The one thing we agree on is that as we're sitting around this table right now, we are not conscious of God. We are in total ignorance of God. Okay, we are in total ignorance. It's a human condition. It's a condition of this world, this ignorance of God. And it's not like, I'm struggling with this, but everyone else has got it down. No, we're all in the same situation, and it's a condition of existence. Okay? It's a lack of a sense of the presence of God and the God in his own most self, how that even relates at all. In other words, we are a place in which the ignorance of God exists. We are all that way, most of the time. And some of us may have glimpses of the unification, but most of the time we're ignorant of it. And this is what's, and if that's so, it then it's the way that it is, cosmically, ontologically, this is a problem in God's world, that he is not known. It's a problem. And the Kabbalist here, the Hasidic thinker here, is facing squarely into that. The ignorance of God, the lack of the awareness of God's total unity, a unity, a oneness beyond one, before you can even begin to count. That lack of awareness, the fact that we're sitting with that lack of awareness is the sign of a disharmony here that is important to God and important to us. And the working through of this, the coming to a greater awareness of unity, which here the Hasidic teacher is saying, one does through prayer. And just the prayer itself, which is that I can talk to God, even on its most basic level. That my illness that I'm experiencing, heaven forbid, is itself part of, if there's a creature suffering in the world, then God's world is not whole. God's will certainly is not complete if there is a creature suffering in his world. Okay? And my illness now is played out, we're getting these medical anthropological terms, on a cosmic scale, which also, you ask him if I believe this, I also believe that. But anthropologically, it's being played out on a cosmic scale. Okay? And so in a certain sense, whether you buy the theology or don't buy the theology, whether you see exactly what he's doing or not, you can certainly see that the illness has been externalized, projected cosmically, and then that cosmic concern has been sort of introjected back into the patient. The patient no longer, the ill person, no longer sees him or herself as, I'm the suffering person and my this aches and that aches. The person says, I'm part of a cosmic process, the working out of which is my illness. And it's not just focused on me. In fact, I'm not at all focused on me anymore. What can I do to help God, so to speak, or God's will in the process of unification and greater consciousness? Okay, so there's that, in a fairly sophisticated way, there's a projection to the other. That's the healing of the illness. Now, projection of the other, again, in an anthropological sense, that already is useful. It gets me away from self-absorption that is the hallmark of illness. Illness is, my ear aches, my ear aches, my ear aches. My stomach aches, my stomach aches, my stomach aches. When I project away from that in almost any way, that's already the beginning of a cure. Then to see this as a shift in consciousness itself is much an even more profound and lasting and transforming kind of healing. That's the Degel Machnet front, yeah. You're right. If that were all that it was, I wouldn't be interested in this text. That's more divine plumbing. What we're interested here is he's saying this. How does he experience this? The hallmark of mysticism, theurgy thus defined is just another kind of theology, and it's on the outside. As scholars of mysticism, our interest should be, what's the experience here? How does that work itself out in consciousness? Okay, and this is what I'm trying to get across. You can say it all on the outside, and you got it down pat. you know, that won't heal you. That won't be this experience. That's not the prayer. That will not heal you. To know that, and you know, it's as you might say, this is classic theurgy. It will get you nowhere. You got to get into the to know what it means to say. What does a Kabbalist mean to say that he's unifying the sphera of Tiferet and the sphera of Malchut? That is not plumbing. This is being in the process, and I'm trying to explain it to you in a phenomenological sense. Okay. You don't need the word Tiferet, and you don't need the word Malchut. I'm telling you, you need the consciousness of what Tiferet is referring to, and the consciousness of what Malchut is referring to. In general sense, my consciousness of presence of God and God as He is in Himself, they're really one and the same. But until I can achieve a consciousness that understands that oneness, I'm not there yet. Okay. And in other words, I'll say just one more thing. Where I become the ground, my consciousness becomes the ground of the awareness of divine unity. You need the experience that what you're doing is that, and it's different than the knowledge. It's that and more.
You cannot bring yourself to really pray and achieve the divine unification.
And I'm saying that unless you know what the experience of Tiferet is and the experience of Shekhinah Malchut is, these two spherot that we're talking about, unless you know what this corresponds to in consciousness, you've missed the point.
Sure, absolutely. Okay? I do agree with you. So, however, you need the epistemic knowledge to begin with.
Okay. And I'm saying it's different than that. All right, but we don't belabor the point.
Everyone, what's at stake here, okay? Because you just watched basically what you watched is two periods in Jewish mystical tradition and dialogue with one another, okay? Gurdy is coming out of the classical Kabbalistic system, which apparently you did some of on the blackboard to your dissatisfaction, from what I gather. And that is a structure that makes you concentrate on specific aspects of the divine. Now this whole system has undergone a large measure of internalization and subjectification within the Hasidic movement, which is a movement that emerged about 250 years ago, where the same language was kept, but very much internalized into the person without going beyond the objective thing, but finding it within. Now the question is, what is happening in that process? Gurdy's reading is, you still have to retain the older structures, be aware of them, and yet internalize them. Mayer's reading is, it's become so internalized that at this point it's not, you can keep the structures, you don't need to anymore even be aware of their external names and the external structures, even though obviously culturally these writers are aware of them, but their message is such that it can be translated into an experiential dimension and be extracted from the technical dimension. The implications of this difference are very obvious. Mayer is creating a system whereby he can translate all this for everyone here, pagans included, without having to buy into any specific language or any specific system. It becomes purely grounded in consciousness, where Gurdy's message or Gurdy's way of reading actually only makes sense for someone that's buying into the system. So what you see is really three stages of dialogue: the earlier stage, the Hasidic stage, and the contemporary stage of translation by Mayer.
Good. And that's quite accurate. I just want to add one thing. Yeah, totally accurate. I just would add one thing. Yeah. Alone, let me just add that it's my contention, and now I'm speaking as an academic, that the very earliest stages of Kabbalah, and this is Rav Isaac the Blind, and what I tried to show, he's working at this level of consciousness experience, and it, rather than the technicality, he develops a language that's technical. That what happens in subsequent generations for several centuries is a focus on the technicality and, to some extent, losing the consciousness of the experience. Not entirely, I mean, but that's there's a certain routinization and scholasticizing of the process. Okay, let's do one more text. I hope that this won't push you too hard, but This is from a favorite book of mine by Rav Chaim of Volozhin, 18th century, straight Kabbalistic, Lithuanian Kabbalistic tradition. He was the student colleague of the Vilna Gaon, of Elijah Vilna, the great one of the greatest Kabbalist of the 18th century. And he speaks in his Nefesh HaChaim, the book Nefesh HaChaim of Chaim Volozhin says, this is a chapter dealing with the nature of mystical prayer. And I'm going to kind of cruise through this text, okay, and then we'll talk about it. Let me just really cruise through it. He says, even though it is an established law in the Talmud that an individual may add something new in his prayer regarding his personal needs or suffering, in each blessing according to its theme. In other words, we talked about the Amida prayer, a prayer that covers petitionary prayer for the basic human needs, for health, for wisdom, for moral, moral perfection, for health, for wealth, for both crass success, physical success and spiritual success, etc. And you're allowed in this standard liturgy, which is meant, which is spoken collectively, you can add prayers in each appropriate theme for your own needs. You're allowed to pray for yourself. So if someone or someone you know or yourself needs healing, you can put in a prayer for yourself. You need money, you can put in a prayer for yourself. Okay? And even though it's permissible to do this, he says, fourth line, this is not the proper way for those who are sincere in their hearts. In truth, it's a wonder how it is relevant to petition and implore him at all for the cessation of one's pain and suffering. How can you ever pray to God for healing? As in the case of physical healing, if the physician gives him a sharp medicine to drink, or if the physician is obliged to amputate a limb entirely in order to prevent an infection from spreading, would the patient implore him not to give him the medicine or not to amputate the limb? The patient himself hired him to do this. So how, too, can he pour forth speech before him, blessed be he, before God, to remove sufferings from him? They are the salve and the medicine of life to atone for his sins. As the rabbis say, there is no suffering without sin. Were it not so, how could a sinful soul attain atonement? In other words, one's illness is itself a medicine of healing for one's spiritual development. This is strong stuff. Okay. So, indeed, the aim of focused intent, of kavanah, as Gertie was talking about, should be only for the needs of the Most High. Tzorach gavoah is the term. The needs of the Most High. For where there is profanation of the divine name, such as when the Jewish people are oppressed, and the nations will say they are the people of God, yet they are beaten and oppressed, one is obligated to beseech and perform our prayer before him, blessed be he, over the profanation of his name. This is for his name's sake. Okay, Jamal had mentioned a thing that's sort of similar to this, the notion that the mystic at a certain point may pray to God to help him, because if not, people won't appreciate the helping, the helping hand of God. Or the sheikh yesterday spoke about this as well, right? It was the sheikh, I think, yeah. Okay, but even for an individual in his own pain, even though it does not entail profanation of the name of God, there are still grounds for petitioning him over the great pain there is above when a person languishes in pain below. As they say in the Mishnah of the 6th chapter of the Talmud Sanhedrin, Rabbi Meir says, when a person is in pain, what does the Divine Presence say? My head aches, my arm aches. When we are in pain, God is in pain. He feels your pain, so to speak. I think we know that phrase, from American politics. They also say in the Midrash, Exodus Rabbah, chapter 2, Midrash Song of Songs, in the verse, I sleep, my heart awakes, my twin, etc. Just as for twins, if one has a headache, the other feels it as well. So too, for the Holy One, blessed be he, I am with him in suffering. If we have an ache or a pain, God feels our pain. In the Midrash Tanchum, at the end of, and these are all normative, what he's getting through here is that this is normative text. At the end of chapter of Achrimot, it says, in every salvation that comes to Israel is of the Holy One, blessed be. As it says, I am with him in suffering, and my heart rejoices in your salvation. Rabbi Eliezer says, this is one of the difficult verses that the salvation of the Holy One, blessed be He, is itself the salvation of Israel. It does not say their salvation, but your God, your salvation, is our salvation. Yeah. And of course, that sounds kind of folksy in a certain way. It's kind of mythic. But again, this has a real experiential dimension. And he zings it home here. And you're right. I mean, that's a very nice association with this. He zings it home. This is the punchline, that last five lines, six lines. When a person does not feel his own pain from his sufferings, on account of his great bitterness over his suffering, as it were, God's suffering, this bitterness is the very essence of the cleansing of his sins. This atones for him to the point that his own sufferings will depart from him. And this is the great holiness of God's way, that he sweetens the bitter through the bitter. And this is the healing of the attributes at their root. Okay, that's the strategy here. So according to the Nefesh HaChaim, of Chaim of Volozhin, the proper way to pray to God for healing is not to pray for ourselves. Not even to pray for other people who we care about. The real way is to recognize that if we are ill, that God himself feels our pain. And in a certain sense, even more than we do. Because whatever he feels, so to speak, he feels infinitely. And what this means is that if there is a creature in his creation that is suffering, any being in his creation that is suffering, his will for the perfection of creation is incomplete. It's unrealized. And it's injured. And that is the very essence of pain, divine pain. So if we cease to consider our own bitterness because of our greater bitterness for God's suffering, if I'm not well, and I'm not functioning in his world the way he intends us all to be, which is our perfect, you know, maximal, you know, pumped up self, as you say. If we're not functioning that way, his will is not whole. There is pain in his creation. Your suffering is not your own personal little problem only. It's his problem. His world's not working right. Okay? And that's the shift of perspective that Rav Chaim of Volozhin is asking us to take. That's how, we don't pray for ourselves. Both of these texts, in a certain sense, share a similar vision. I mean, and share this vision very broadly with other faith traditions as well. According to both of them, the therapeutic intent of the patient is a double motion. It's a release to the other. It's an externalizing of your self-concern to the concern for the other, in this case with a capital O, pointing outwards. And then you internalize the other, returning inwards, as the other who, you know, really cares for you in a more than you care for yourself. Who's closer to you than you are to yourself. And the point is this, that the experience of illness is solipsistic, self-centered, self-absorbed, and we're focused on our own pain and our own bodies as an object. And this leads to a narrowing circle of attention. And it limits our resources for healing. I'm speaking very practically now. It can lead to exacerbating the condition, the recycling of pain. Talk about, you know, how pain control strategies involve getting the patient to break the cycle of recycling pain. It can lead to stress and other self-defeating reactions. Healing involves a shift to the other. It's a self-transcendence, and yet recognizing that that other is our radical higher innerness. In Rav Chaim of Volozhin's terms, it's a shift of concern to God, yet God feeling our pain more intimately than we do. In the Degel Machne Ephraim's terms, it's the unity of God as transcendent and God as immanent, and understanding God as one, really getting that mystery. Okay. So there's an externalizing of our body concern and shifting to another. Okay. And I would say Thomas Chordis in his work Sacred Self, and this is a medical anthropological work, says, quote, this is a nice quote, "The patient comes to participate in the cosmic, and the cosmic comes to intimately inhabit the traumatic moments of the patient's autobiography." It's this double motion. And this allows the patient to think in different terms about himself or herself, to become motivated in new ways, to speak very practically here, It's a change in the patient's interpretation of his or her relational world, major shift of perspective, transformative shift of perspective. It's cognitive, but it's also emotional. It can have even direct effects on the limbic system and on the hypothalamus, and allowing for reduction of stress and opening of tremendous potential for healing that's already in the human body, as well as even miraculous healings that we've spoken about. And so this is an example of mystical prayer, the experience of mystical prayer in the service of healing. And we see that the healing experience, the illness experience and the healing experience becomes transformed as a cosmic repair, as a cosmic healing in itself. Yes?
It's going through the stages of afterlife. And what I ended up arguing was that this one statement is a direction to the mourners, and it, by not crying, by not disturbing the dead person, they have to get beyond their own pain and have compassion for the person who died. And think of them more than their own suffering. So that what the book was doing was offering the mourners who are in such intense pain an opportunity to think of somebody else and get past. So the way you're talking about how when you're ill and you offer prayers to God to, because his suffering will be that much more traumatic, you're asking yourself to get beyond your own pain. In the same way, I was seeing that the Tibetan community is asking of its own people to get beyond their mourning and consider that the person who's dying is going through a much more traumatic experience trying to get through the stages of afterlife than your loss.
That's a very interesting connection. There's more that can be said about the Jewish perspective on this. I don't get into that.
Yeah.
But the distinction that you're making and to relate that to this strategy, if I call it a spiritual strategy, I think is very much to the point. In a certain sense, there's a kind of spiritual breathing process going on here. It's you exhale a wounded and kind of contracted self to otherness, and then you inhale a pure divine otherness that becomes your most interior, you know, self, closer to you than you are to yourself. And in this way, come to realize that, you know, that God's will is always already helping to heal us and to support us and to guide us in the world. Formalistically, I've been pointing out the similarities. I think you can point to a lot of distinctions as well. I'm not going to dwell on that. I think you can analyze the distinctions. And yet, in a certain way, and this more or less in kind of offered to Gertie as an approach, I see Rav Chaim of Elozhin getting on the inside of the experience that the Nigel Machne Ephraim is expressing from the classical, as you say, it's a point well taken, from the classical, in the classical formal Kabbalistic terms. The Rav Chaim of Elozhin is getting us inside what that process is like. This is strong medicine. I'd rather let's finesse that. This takes a lot of theological ground to support and to convey this in a appropriately sympathetic way. We don't like this idea in the 20th century, but yeah. He's setting the ground. I mean, you can talk about karma, and you can talk about, you know, you can explain this in many different ways. I don't think we need to. I'd like to just, but we can talk about it personally, you know, directly.
It's so beautiful to see God suffering as in your suffering, and is there a sense there also by praying and recognizing that God is suffering in your suffering, you are creating the other for Him.
Oh, that's a very interesting point. I don't even know what that means. There's a very mythical quality to the way that you express that. To do justice to your statement, I must think about it very deeply. Okay, but thank you for saying that. Very wild. Okay, Harvey.
Just two statements. Paul writes to Titus, and Titus has a stomach ache. I remember this vividly because I was in Paris was being read at table, right? just a brief reading of scripture before dinner. And the French love their wine, right, as we all do. And Paul says, if you have an upset stomach, take a little wine for your stomach. All right? So it's not prayer. Okay. I have no problem with faith healing. I'll say something about that a bit later. Then secondly, the way you were pushing on suffering in God, our suffering, etc. I have a poem that I will read. I hesitated, but I think I will read from Jacopone de Todi. He's an extremely powerful love poem, which follows up.
Great. So.
About the Chaim of Volozhin text, it's not only the shifting of consciousness to the other. There's more here, because the bitterness of realizing God's suffering really creates a movement of repentance and suffering for your own sins. And there's a process where, I think this text assumes there's a drossness or something that's built into you that's melted away through the suffering. So if you look at the last paragraph, he says, when a person does not feel his own pain from his sufferings, but only God's, this bitterness is the very essence of the cleansing of his sins. This atones for him to the point that his own sufferings will depart from him. So, concerning Noel's question, we do have to take the notion of sin as source of suffering something more seriously. And this shift of consciousness goes beyond the psychological and transformative dimensions that you suggested, Mayor, into a theory of repentance and how the physical imprints of sin are purged from the body.
Okay, it's a good point, but I would say that what's my sense of this, and we can pursue this in more detail, but my sense of it is that the reason, the essence of sin itself is self-absorption, on whatever the sin is. And that the healing of the sin, as well as the healing of the illness that comes from the sin, is through that same projection to God. In other words, whenever I can project beyond my self-absorption, I heal the causes for sin in the first place, and the effects of those causes in the illness as well, and a shift that it's one and the same process. That's how I read the text. All right. Thank you. Let's stop here. Oh, sorry. Oh, I didn't see it. My peripheral vision. Yeah.
And Mark, on the theme of illness and healing in Buddhism, the metaphor of illness and healing is one of the basic ones for Buddhist tradition. Yeah. Buddha himself is a healer, a doctor, and Four Noble Truths are like medical diagnosis. For example, First Noble Truth, all the suffering, it is diagnosis as such. A healer see Buddha as a healer, sees the suffering persons or beings, and he states the diagnosis. Then the second noble truth is etiology, or the cause of suffering. Then the third noble truth, so that there is a state without suffering, or nirvana, is but prognosis, that the health is possible. And the fourth noble truth is but healing or curing itself, a noble path. And another example, very interesting. Buddha said that all the doctrines and abstract metaphysical questions are excessive for liberation. And in this relation, he gives one metaphorical example. There is a person who was wounded by an arrow, by a poisonous arrow, And there is a healer who is able to cure his wound. But the wound person says, you can't cure me before you explain me who you are, who are your parents, who are your teachers, what disciplines did you study, etc., etc. That person will be dead before he will be able to know all these subjects. Yeah. And Buddha concludes, I am a doctor, a healer, and I give you the way of healing. And you ask me about very abstract problems.
Right, exactly. That's exactly it. Good. Well said.
I would just like to look at the idea of sin in the sense of us turning our face away from God. And I think that when someone is ill, family and friends, if they know that there's a problem with your health, they become even more loving and kind towards you. And in a sense, that is, you know, love of neighbor, love of children, and so on. This is the turning one's face back to God, again, as I see it. And so in that sense, I think there is a very positive aspect of the healing or the suffering or the pain in God is helped by the way people respond to people who are ill and sick.
Beautiful.
And I was thinking when you were talking about your community and that night of prayer, and in my mind I had an image of the vessels and the sparks. And I was thinking of what the Baal Shem Tov said about when good people are together, you see the sparks, actually see them flying. And I was thinking that all of these people, your whole community and yourself, and all these lovely thoughts and prayers for this woman were, in a way, the sparks were flying not just between each of you, but it was like the vessels were overflowing and the sparks were descending to the earth and back to God. So there was this kind of two-way flow of healing between God and the community and the person. And it just struck me that there is a very positive thing happening there.
That's how we saw it too. Beautiful. Thanks.
I had gotten the impression, or at least from my very quick looking at these two things, that there's some difference coming for me between healing oneself through self-healing through mystical prayer and the healing of the other, or meaning another person, not sort of a general other. And I was just wondering, is there that, because I got the sense that the first one, the Rabbi Moshe, I am Ephraim one, yeah, was the way you were presenting it was as sort of an expert healer healing, or I mean,
oh,
but sort of the medium of the expert healer was somehow central. Whereas in the second one, the first one on the sheet,
I wasn't perhaps being conveying it the way I meant to, which I think is that I see both of them as him talking about the prayer that one has, you know, as the person who needs healing, how one prays and how one sees one's own illness. This is from a more personal perspective. I think you can use some of this as a healer, and in fact, a healer's awareness of this process can be extremely powerful, not just for doctors, but for clergy persons as well. I mean, it's. And that's what I would argue that. But I think both of them are talking from the personal perspective, what the experience of one's own prayer for healing can be. Okay? Go what?
Summary.
Oh, one of the... We examined a practical example of mystical prayer in the service of healing, a petitionary prayer, and strategies for healing prayer in the Kabbalistic and the Hasidic tradition, and noted certain commonalities with spiritual healing traditions in general as a projection of one's concern to an other, the externalization of one's concern to an other, and ultimately other with a capital O, and a re-internalizing of the concerns of the other within oneself, who experiences one's suffering even more intimately than you yourself do. This is the essence of the healing experience through prayer, as getting you outside of yourself and the solipsistic experience of illness, projecting you back out to the world as a definition of what healing is in itself, body and self consciousness fully and healthily projected out into the world.